Well, he is already by far one of the most beloved Disney characters of all time. His name is Olaf, and he is a snowman. I don't know if you've already seen Frozen or Frozen 2. Maybe you have seen it, maybe you haven't. But if you haven't seen it, Olaf is the new character for Disney, and he is the one who brings the comedic, the humorous element to Frozen and to Frozen 2. So if you haven't seen it, here's some of the funniest parts. In the first movie, one of the funniest songs you'll ever hear written, it's one of my favorites. It's just absolute genius, every single line of it. It's got Olaf the snowman dreaming about what summer must be like, about what it's like to lie on the burning sand, about what it's like to get gorgeously tanned, and he ponders about what it's like when solid water gets warm. What happens when that happens? Well, Frozen 2 came out this past Christmas. My kids have already seen it 2 and 3 times. If you haven't seen it yet, I won't spoil the whole movie for you, but Olaf is in it again, and Olaf is even funnier than ever. But this time, as always, in so many good movies and good stories, the comedic element makes you laugh, but it's actually meant to drive home some of the most important themes of the story. And in Frozen 2, Olaf's purpose is to drive home the theme of the search for a joy that is permanent, which of course is ironic for a snowman looking for something that is permanent. And so in one scene, Olaf says this to Princess Anna. Tell me, you're older and thus all-knowing. Do you ever worry about the notion that nothing is permanent? Anna then sings a song called Some Things Never Change, where she speaks about certain joys that she says she can completely rely on, like love. Here's some of the lyrics from the song. She sings, yes, some things never change, like the feel of your hand in mine. Some things stay the same, like how we get along just fine. Like an old stone wall that'll never fall. Some things are always true. Some things never change, like how I'm holding on tight to you. And it makes you feel good in all this, but it's all meant to foreshadow the rest of the story. Even in the song, Olaf is running along the stone wall as she sings about it, and it collapses underneath him as he jumps over top of it. Then, in the rest of the story, Anna's views are shown to be incredibly naive, and Olaf's great anxiety about nothing being permanent is shown to be accurate. The joys that Anna thought were true, that so many of the characters think are true, are shown to be impermanent. For instance, relationships break down. Queen Elsa pushes little Olaf away and Anna away, and Olaf the snowman experiences for the very first time in his existence the anger that comes from betrayal. The mighty kingdom of Arendelle, which is supposed to be so permanent and lasting, is shown to be rotten to the core and begins to fall apart. And it all reaches a low point when Olaf says these words to Anna when all is getting dark in the movie. He says, "You said some things never change. But since then, everything has done nothing but change." And then the magic that holds Olaf the snowman together disappears. And to the shock and the horror of all the children in the theater, Olaf disintegrates and dies. Yes, it's the new version of Bambi's mom, for those of you who are older. Now, I won't tell you the end of the story. I won't ruin it for you, but Disney always has a happy ending. I'll just tell you that. The question that plagued Olaf's mind, do you ever worry about the notion that nothing is permanent? That question is the same question that plagued King Solomon. You remember, we stated his thesis question. He gives right at the very beginning of the book in chapter 1 and verse 3. Here it is. Here's his thesis question. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? The key word there is gain. That's a banking term, as we've said. It refers to a surplus. What is left over after all the bills have been paid? What is left? And Solomon is saying that we put all this effort, all this toil into our lives. We give so much time to relationships, to hobbies, to our jobs, to our education, to our careers, and all of that. And when all is said and done, Solomon is asking the question, what remains? What's left on the balance sheet of life? What is permanent? And Solomon learns throughout this book, and just as we are, what Olaf learned. He says, Solomon says, nothing remains. And the word he uses, remember we've been learning the Hebrew word the last few weeks, and the word is hevel. You're doing well, you're doing well. Pronounced with, or written with a B, pronounced with a V, hevel. And hevel means a breath. It means breath. It means vapor. It means mist. And so metaphorically, what he's saying with that, he's saying your life and my life, like a breath, are short and fleeting. Your life and mine, like a breath, are also elusive. You can't shape it and grab it and form it into something that's going to last. It's going to disappear. Really, life is like a snowman. It's here and then it's gone. And this whole book is one great speech by this great King Solomon to convince you that you and I, like Anna, are incredibly naive. We often refuse to face reality for what it is. We refuse to accept this reality that all is hevel. And then as a result, we, like Anna, experience so much suffering, so much sorrow, because we don't have a clear picture of reality. We don't face it like we ought to. And so what he's trying to do in this book is to help us become convinced, to really get down deep in our being, that all is hevel, all is a breath. And when we see that, then we can make the turn. Then we can now learn what it means to live wisely and to live with joy. But the only way you get that, Solomon says, is if you've got to come to this conclusion that all is hevel. So here's what he's going to do today. Today, he's given us conclusion, all is hevel. Now he's going to show us the experiment that he went on in order to come to this conclusion. Then we're going to mourn the result of his conclusion with him. And then we're going to turn the corner and we're going to have a change in perspective. The change in perspective that allows us to live wisely with our very short lives and to live with joy. So that's where we want to go today. We're going to do those three things. Let's join the experiment. Let's mourn the results. And then let's get our change in perspective. Okay, so let's track this. First of all, let's join the experiment. Look with me in chapter 2 and verse 1. Solomon the preacher says, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you. It's an experiment. I'm going to test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was hevel. This was a breath. Remember, every time you see the word vanity, substitute it just with the word breath or vapor. Everything was breath. Now, this word pleasure, we could easily take that to mean, you know, forbidden pleasures. But that's not what he means. It's just simply the word to refer to the things that gladden the hearts of people, the things that bring us joy that we find in life. So what he's saying is he wants to go on an experiment, and he wants to do the things that human beings do that gladden our hearts, in order to discover if there's anything that's permanent, if there's anything that we do that brings us joy that lasts. That's what he's trying to do. And of course, he tells us his conclusion again right away. He says, nope, the end result is everything is a breath. There's much joy along the way, but nothing lasts. Everything is a breath here and then gone. Laughter, he says, is mad. Not that it's bad. Laughter's not bad. It is mad in the sense that it doesn't last forever. It's here, and then it's gone. And so he asks in verse 2, what really use is it to have a glad heart? And he does not answer the question yet, but what he does is he takes us on the rest of his experiment. So let's join him now. In verse 3, he begins his experiment with a test case. And the test case is with wine. He uses wine as a test case. Notice carefully, very carefully with me, he does not say that he went on a binge drink weekend with all of his buddy kings from around the ancient Near East. That's not what he does. He's not saying that he became an alcoholic and he tried all this out. That's not what's going on. Here's why that's not exactly what's going on. Notice in verse 3, he clearly says that even as he's enjoying a glass of wine, quote, my heart was still guiding me with wisdom. He still has his wits about him. He has his mind about him. So his body, his senses are enjoying a nice glass of wine, but he's making sure he's got his mind about him and he's being guided by wisdom. So here we see again this biblical view of things like wine. On the one hand, wine is a good gift from God. It's to be received with thanksgiving from the Creator. So later, for instance, in chapter 9 and verse 7, listen to this verse. Go, eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart. Why? for God has already approved of what you do. So a biblical view of wine then begins with it's a good gift from the Creator. But then the Bible's always going to follow this up and say, make sure you do not abuse God's good gifts. And so Solomon himself, who writes much of the book of Proverbs, much of it anyways, constantly in there is saying, it is the fool who takes God's good gift of wine and uses it for drunkenness. For drunkenness is not only a sin, drunkenness will also destroy your entire life. So some of us need to hear, hey, wine is a good gift of God that he's already approved that you can drink it. That's on the one side. But some of us also need to hear, be careful with it. Do not, like all of God's good gifts to us, like food even, for instance, do not abuse the good gift. Do not take it and use it in ways it's not intended to be used. Which side do you maybe need to hear this morning? Well, this sermon is not meant to go into a big, long discussion on the use of wine. I only get a paragraph, so maybe you got lots of questions. We can talk after. Let's not lose the main point here, though. Here's the experiment. The experiment is he's letting his senses enjoy a nice glass or two of Merlot. And he's sitting there enjoying it and he's drinking it, but he's using his mind while he's enjoying his senses, the taste, and all this kind of stuff. And he's pondering where the folly of wine would take you. And he's pondering the goodness and the joy that will bring. And his question over it all is, does anything last out of it? Is there a permanent gain that comes out of it? Again here, people misunderstand, I think, Ecclesiastes chapter 2. A lot of people look at this entire passage and they say, okay, what Solomon's doing here is he's trying out all the things in life. He's trying out drunkenness, sex with all the women in the world, career success and money. And at the end, he's saying it's all meaningless, and so you need to turn to God. That's often how people read Ecclesiastes 2. But I hope to show you, I don't think that's what he's doing. Already we've seen when he drinks his wine, his wisdom is sticking with him. He's keeping a clear mind. But notice very clearly that his point is not to discover the overall meaning of life. Look at the second half of verse 3. Notice he says, he's doing all this till I might see what was good for the children of man, that is the children of Adam, to do under heaven during the few days of their life. So he's not trying to find the meaning of life. It's more specific. That's what we keep saying. He's experimenting with all the things that we do as human beings that gladden our hearts in order to see if anything lasts. That's what he's really specifically doing. Wine was the test case. Now he gives a bunch of other examples of things, good things, that God has given human beings to do that gladden our hearts to see if anything lasts. So he begins to describe his career, his work, and his hobbies. Look at verses 4-7 with me. He says, I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. So Solomon then devoted himself to decades of projects of his career and all this kind of stuff, hobbies, because they would gladden his heart, and he did all kinds of things. I mean, he built a lot. If you go read the Old Testament, he built residential houses. He built commercial buildings. He built military buildings. He built his own palace, which took 13 years. He actually built multiple cities as well. And all of this is not, you're not to read this as him boasting of his great achievements as if he's too great. That's not what's going on. He's just recounting the things he did in his life. And all this is meant to be interpreted positively. Here's how I know that. That little phrase back in verse 3, what was good for the children of man, that is what is good for the children of Adam to do. Once again, we see Solomon is reflecting on Genesis chapters 1 and 2. You can see it in that little phrase, the children of Adam, but you can really see it in what we just looked at. Because what did Adam do? Just go back to Genesis 1 and 2. What did God command Adam to do? To work the garden, to subdue the earth, that is to take all the resources of the earth, to cultivate it for human flourishing, to build culture, to build cities, all these kind of things, and to have lots of kids. That's basically what God's command was to Adam. As human beings, we were made to do work, to do projects, right? And what's amazing is if you look at this little paragraph of the things that he did, almost every single line has an exact word taken straight from Genesis chapter 1 or Genesis chapter 2. Here's the exact words. The words plant, garden, trees of all fruits, water, sprout, to do, to make, all those are words from Genesis 1 and chapter 2. So Solomon is saying, God commanded us to go out and to work the earth. That's what I did. He says, I found joy in this kind of stuff. I gave myself to all of this work. This is what I spent my time doing under the sun, because this is what God has given human beings to do under the sun. And then he describes all the wealth that was gained through this. Look at verse 7. He talks about how the fact that he bought slaves and had slaves. Don't get tripped up by this. This is not the Bible endorsing slavery. We're not even having a moral discussion on slavery right here. Just simply saying that he had them. The bigger picture here is simply to say, does this bring lasting joy? Now, of course, now we could digress and have a conversation about that, but we don't want to get sidetracked with this. Notice it's what he's saying in the second half of verse 8. Let's camp out there. Second half of verse 8, I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than anyone who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delights of the sons of man. So again, if you've ever read the Old Testament, Solomon had tremendous wealth, tremendous wealth. He enjoyed lots of entertainment on things like music and all that. That last little phrase about concubines, that's also very difficult. If you have a Bible, there is a footnote in almost any translation, and if you look at the footnote, the translators say the meaning of the Hebrew word is uncertain. So it's a guess. It's a pretty good educated guess because Solomon did have lots of concubines. Again, not a comment on whether that's right or wrong, simply stating that he had them. Now, you've stuck with me well. Here comes the summary. Look at the summary in verses 9 and 10. After the experiment, he says, so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Again, he's not boasting. It was God who promised to give him wisdom. It was God who promised to give him great wealth, and exactly that happened. So again, here's what I'm trying to show you. I don't think he's trying to say, I tried to find meaning in career success, to find meaning in alcohol or in sex and these types of things. The point of the experiment was to look at all the things that we do that gladden our hearts, especially the work God has given us, and to see if anything lasts. And here's my clincher point why I think this is correct. If you look at verse 10, notice he says, my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. So he does not conclude that it was all meaningless. That's not his conclusion. He says, I found tremendous joy in my work. I found tremendous joy in my projects and in my gardens that I planted. And now what he's doing, he's stepping back from all of his life, from this giant experiment, and now he's asking this big question. What do I have to show for it all? He's asking Olaf's question. Will anything be permanent after all this experiment? Will anything be left after all is said and done? After all the things that I've given myself to, is anything permanent? And that's the question you got to ask about your life too. For all of your career success, for all of your jobs, your hobbies, your relationships, when it's all said and done, is there any gain? Is there a surplus? Is anything permanent? So, let's come to the second point now, and let's look at the result. We've joined the experiment. Now, let's mourn the result. Mourn the result. Here it comes, verse 11. Look at verse 11 with me. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was heffel. All was a breath, vapor, and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Now mark carefully again, he's not saying that there was no joy or gladness in his life from all the things that he did. Because right before this he says, I had lots of joy in the things that I did. But just as it is impossible to take the wind, to capture it and shape it into something that could last, or to grab onto your breath and to make it last, now what he's saying is, at the end of it all, everything is fleeting. But then he anticipates an objection. What if you've worked your whole life for all this wealth and all these things? You could say you have gain, you have a surplus, if you can take all of that and give it to your kids, give them an inheritance. He ponders this in verses 18 to 23, and I'll just summarize it for you. Here's his answer. He says, yes, that might be something that remains at the end of your life, but what if the person to whom you give all of your wealth and achievements is a fool? All of your efforts then will have been in vain. And the great irony is, this is exactly what happened to Solomon. Solomon's son Rehoboam inherited all his wealth, his gigantic kingdom. Rehoboam got everything. And within a very short little while, Rehoboam made some very foolish decisions, which led to civil war, the kingdom being split in half, and the kingdom, two kingdoms now, at war with one another. Within just a few years, decades after Solomon dies, this is what happens. Oh, hevel, hevel. Everything is hevel. And so Solomon, at this point in his experiment, falls into discouragement and even into despair. But I want you to notice again, this is not because he lived a godless life trying to find meaning in all the things of the world, and now he's going to turn to God. That's not why he's falling into despair. He falls into despair because all the effort he put into his projects does not result in any permanent gain. Everything he has done is just a breath that is here, and then it's gone. So think about our lives. Same thing. Let's think work is one of the greatest things we give ourselves to in our lives. Let me just give you an example from a man named Glenn Fobert. He was an engineer who worked at a manufacturing plant in Ontario. For 20 years he did this, and then the plant was shut down, and Fobert was laid off. And here's what he writes. 2 years later, I returned to the plant and toured the empty shell of the building in the cold of winter. The men were gone. The machinery was gone. The lights were out, and the rain had leaked through the roof, forming puddles of ice. I was depressed by the sight and began to wonder if all the effort I had put into keeping that old plant operating was worth it. And that's the question that you and I come to as well. For all of your effort in your career, I mean, thank you for your kindness on my doctorate, so I think, yes, I've done some things. I have a dissertation completed and all this kind of stuff. That's wonderful. But here's now the question. When you die, is there anything of lasting, permanent gain? For all your projects, for all your hobbies, for everything you have invested in, is there any gain? And Solomon's answer is no. Nothing remains. All is but a breath. Let me translate that for you on the West Coast in recent memory right here. All is a snowman in Victoria, which is here for a couple days and then gone with no evidence to show it was ever there. Right, Edelman's? Where are the Edelman's at? Edelman's made the CTV news for their 13.5-foot snowman. That was some toil that they put in to do that. And now there's no evidence it was even there. That is what Solomon is saying to us. So you could, if you want to, here's your West Coast translation of this book. Snowman, snowman, everything is a snowman. And make sure you add in Victoria. That's the big picture of this book. You put all this toil and work into it, and you enjoy it. It's great fun. And then it is gone. And Solomon has been driving home the point that we'll be gone and eventually we will be forgotten. Author Julian Barnes reminds us that when we die, of course, some people are going to remember that you existed. Some people for a while will remember your achievements and they'll talk about you. But then he says, don't forget, a day will finally come when there will just be one person left in the world who remembers who you were and the things that you did. Only one person will finally visit your grave. And then that person also will die. And the hard reality is you and everything you have done will be forgotten. And then just to try to bring a little bit of humor to this otherwise depressing reality, Barnes says this, there is one more person who will visit your grave. Quote, the man driving the earth digger who scoops out your remnants when the graveyard is sold off for suburban housing. That's some dark humor right there. But what Barnes is saying is what Solomon's saying. You got to face reality. This is reality. So now here's the point we get to. And I want to make sure I make all this point clear, because this is where maybe some of you are struggling with this entire series. What should we conclude then? If all of life is hevel, should we just give up and say it's all just meaningless? What's the point to it anyways? Should we just fall into despair? Should we just leave here and go jump off the bridge? Well, now Johnson Street's not very high. You probably won't die anyways. But you'll get really cold. Should we just go do that? Should we be in despair? I mean, this is how some people say you should go this direction. Think about probably the most famous example of this is Shakespeare's Macbeth. You remember? When Macbeth, his wife has died, the armies are marching against him. And Shakespeare puts into Macbeth's mouth some of the most famous words in all of Western literature when he says this: "Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more." Shakespeare says, life is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Is that where we should go? He's correct in one level. It's all a breath. It's all going to be gone. So does that therefore mean that it's all just a tale told by an idiot? Is it meaningless? Does it signify nothing? Solomon's answer is no. Face reality, but that is not the conclusion that you should come to. It is not meaningless. Just because something is fleeting does not mean that it is meaningless. Rather, this fact should cause you to have a complete change in perspective that allows you to live wisely and to live with joy. So we joined him on his experiment. Glad I'm done having to say that. We've mourned with him the results. Now let's come to the final thing and listen to Solomon's call to change your perspective. To change your perspective. You can see that there's a major change in perspective between the despair of verse 23 and the start of verse 24. Look at how chapter 2 and verse 24 begins, where he says, "There is nothing better for a person." Rough translation, here's the best way for you to live. This is the way now that you should live in light of all that. And what is really important to recognize is that what he's saying in verses 24 to 26, as I showed you last week, this is the first conclusion to the book. So he's gone through all this, and now this is a conclusion. So this is really important, what he is about to say here. Up to this point, he has given us a giant reality check that even though there is meaning and joy in our work, nothing we do will last. Everything is but a puff. We will be forgotten, and this should change our perspective. How should it change it? Let's read verses 24 to 26 again together. "There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God, for apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. And this side of the sinner," he says, "this also is a breath. It's a striving after wind." So what he's saying is those who do not know God, who devote their lives to things like money and power in order to get some lasting gain, he says, it's not going to work. It's all just a breath. But what does God give to the one who lives for him? When a person centers their life on Jesus, centers their life on God, what does God give that person? Wisdom, knowledge, and joy. So what he's calling us to do is to accept reality that everything is a puff of breath. And then when you see this, it should change the way you view things. So now you enjoy the good gifts God has given you for today, not trying to use them for some great thing. Like here would be the ultimate wrong thing for me to do right now, to say, I wrote a dissertation so my name will be remembered through all of history. Solomon will say, breath. You're going to die, you're going to be forgotten, and your dissertation is going to disappear under all the sands of time. That's what he would say to me. And it's the same for everything that we do. So it humbles us way down, but what it should do then, it changes our perspective to say, but enjoy the moment. So for me, in this particular project, I found great joy in doing it. My own life was changed. I hope that my work, when I preached the sermons, it affected you in those days. You've probably forgotten the sermons by now, but hopefully they were helpful for you at that time. And now, hopefully as a book, maybe for a little while longer, it can help people in the moment to have joy and to know their Creator more. But yes, all my work will be forgotten, and so will I. But that doesn't mean there's no joy right now in it, that there's no joy in making it, and the joy that others can maybe have in helping to change their lives. Think of all of this. Let me put everything together here. Let me give you, there's one story in the Old Testament that captures the whole message of the book of Ecclesiastes. So I said you could translate Ecclesiastes as breath, breath, everything is breath. I give you another one, snowman, snowman, everything is a snowman. Here's the other one. Here's the story that goes over all of Ecclesiastes. Manna, manna, everything is manna. So in the Old Testament, remember, Israel was crossing the desert on the way to the Promised Land. It was a hard existence for them. Just we said, life can be very hard. But in the midst of all that, God gave them good gifts to enjoy. And one of the gifts was this miraculous gift of manna, which they came out every day and found this kind of bread-like substance that they could eat, and it would sustain them. It tasted good, all this kind of stuff for a while. They started to complain eventually. But it was a good gift of God to them. But what was one of the defining traits of this manna? If you tried to keep it, if you tried to store it up, put it in a jar, what would happen when you opened it the next morning? It was moldy, it was rotten, except for on the Sabbath, if you remember. So there's the picture. This is the picture of the book of Ecclesiastes. Life is hard, life is short, but God also gives many good gifts to you, and you should take those good gifts from God. You should enjoy them in the moment, but don't try to use them for some future gain, some permanent gain, because if you try to do that, it's all just going to rot and become moldy. You can't use it for that. That's not the way God has given his gifts. So all of Ecclesiastes is saying, manna, manna, everything is manna, in both the good sense and the sense that it's all going to disappear. And that's what Solomon has been saying to us. And is that not what Jesus says exactly as well? Jesus says he does not want his children, he does not want the people in his kingdom constantly using all their life filled with anxiety, striving to produce more and more wealth, more and more fame, more and more things. He doesn't want us chasing after all this stuff because it brings so much anxiety. Jesus says, no, I don't want the children in my kingdom to be filled with worry and anxiety. And how do we not do that? He says, center your life on him. Seek first the kingdom of God, and God will provide all these other things for you as well. So it's a matter of priorities. The world strives after all these other things all the time. It's what everybody lives for. Jesus says, oh, there's so much anxiety and worry there. Don't do that. Seek after his kingdom. Yes, work hard at your job and all those kind of things, but live for Jesus first, and you can trust that your heavenly Father will take care of your physical needs. You don't need to stress. You don't need to give your life to trying to amass wealth and fortune, all these things, for they're just going to be a puff of breath that disappears. So you see then, a godly and a wise person recognizes that everything is temporary. We're all going to die. But God has also given us good gifts to be enjoyed along the way. So listen to Glenn Fobert again and the change in perspective that he had. He said, after talking about the plant, remember? He says, my first reaction was depression to the fact that the plant closed and everything was gone. But as I thought of the people who had made a good income while working there, and of the many products made, and the good use they had been put to, I realized that although the plant was now dead, it had served me and many others well. We had, for the most part, enjoyed our work, and I realized that was a great reward. Our work was not meaningless, but the closure and the layoff were disappointing. Isn't that the right perspective? Far too often then, we need to emphasize this joy in the moment thing. Far too often, Christians kind of give off the vibe that if you want to follow Jesus, it's just all going to, you know, you need to deny all the joy. Deny all that. Now, of course, we talk about denial. That's very important, self-denial. But we got to also sound this note of joy in the good gifts that God has given us. Of course, we should not abuse God's good gifts. Yes, let me say it again. Yes, and one more time just to make sure. Do not abuse God's good gifts. But listen, I think the church has done a pretty good job of warning people against sin, warning them not to abuse God's gift, calling out sins. And of course, we need to continue to do that. And I hope you've heard me do that my entire pastoral ministry. But here's my question for us. Have we done an equally good job at celebrating the good gifts that God has given us? Have we done an equally good job at taking His good gifts and saying, oh, what a great creator? Christians, above all people, should be the most joyous, celebratory people in the world. For we know where the good gifts come from. We know to whom all the worship and thanksgiving is due. We know that they come from the hand of a good father, and that our good father intends his children to enjoy the good gifts. Christians, above all people, should be the celebratory people who give thanks for all that God has given us. So throughout his entire book, Solomon will emphasize the fact that yes, life is hard, but God has given us good gifts along the way to be enjoyed. And just so you don't think I'm overstating something, it means no, we are not to give our lives to things like drunkenness. No, not to one-night stands. No, not to all these types of things. But yes, to using God's good gifts in the way he has intended. And is that not what Jesus himself did? Joy and gladness run right through his ministry. We call Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John the Gospels. They are the stories of Jesus' life, right? And Jesus, particularly in the book of Luke, if you track it, he basically goes from one party to another party to another party. Jesus liked going to parties. One commentator writes this: Jesus literally ate his way through the Gospels. Go read the Gospels. If you were to remove all the notions of food and drink and parties, you don't have much left in the Gospels. Because Jesus is always there. In fact, he was doing this so much that the religious leaders of the day made an accusation against him. And the accusation, false, but the accusation was that Jesus was a drunkard and a glutton. Now, how do you make that accusation unless there's at least a grain of truth? And the grain of truth is simply, Jesus liked to go to parties. And as Jesus himself said, unlike John the Baptist, who did not come eating and drinking, the Son of Man came eating and drinking, and you call him a glutton and a drunkard. But of course, he was not. But the truth in it all is that he did enjoy the good gifts that God gave every day, like a good meal with his friends. Jesus always attends weddings. He's always eating meals. He's turning water into the finest of wines to keep a party from falling apart. He describes the kingdom of God as a wedding feast. He says that whenever a sinner turns to God, there's a giant party that goes on in heaven. The angels are all rejoicing. And then he enjoys the Passover feast the night before he dies. And as soon as he's resurrected, there he is, having another meal, cooking fish on the beach and serving up Peter and all the fishing disciples, having breakfast with them. And then the very next story, he's going on a long walk on the road to Emmaus, getting kind of hungry. So he and the disciples stop and have another meal. And he's breaking bread again and again, enjoying and giving thanks to his Father for the good gifts that have given to him. So that's how we ought to live as well. Truly, before your meal, I know before meals we sometimes just do a quick thanks and the words are so, we use them so many times they just quickly go. Why not today at your lunch or your dinner just pause, maybe quote Ecclesiastes 2:24, pause and give true thanks for what you're about to eat, for the flavors, for the taste, for the fact that you have food on your table. So we learn that. But there's even something better that we learn. For Jesus, the true and better and wiser Solomon, revealed something to us that Solomon did not know. Solomon had a very limited understanding of what happens in the afterlife. It's kind of a vague, all through the Old Testament, it's quite vague. But in Jesus, we learn, listen to this, there are some things that last. There are some things that are permanent that we do. It is possible for you to do some things in life that will remain, that will be gain, that will pass right through death. How do they do that? How can something pass through death? Because all through here, Solomon is saying death is the ultimate thing that destroys all gain. How could anything pass through death? Jesus, through his life, his death, and his resurrection, punched a hole right through the center of death, creating a giant hole, defeating death, so that there are some things that can pass through Jesus' resurrection to the other side, to the world to come. And what are those things? Well, Jesus has got quite a list. But for instance, he says, you can use your money in ways that will store up treasures in heaven. That's right. You can spend your money in ways on this earth. That is, in ways that are in accordance with his kingdom, ways that help the poor, ways that do all this. That is money which passes through death, through the resurrection of Jesus, and somehow becomes treasure on the other side. It's possible to gain on the other side. And then, of course, any work that you do, no matter how small, whether it's just giving, as Jesus says, a cup of cold water in his name to somebody who needs it, to the least of these acts somehow pass through death to the other side and remain. For as Paul argues, if Christ has not been raised, then all of your work is truly in vain. However, Paul says Christ has been raised from the dead, and so he calls us to stand firm, and he says, always abounding in the work of the Lord. Why? Because you know that your labor is not in vain. There is some labor that is not going to disappear like a puff of breath. And that is anything that you do for the work of the Lord. Anything you do for Jesus, the smallest act, passes through death through the resurrection of Jesus. So put it all together. Yes, we all die. Yes, life is a breath. And since this is true, the wise and godly person does not devote their life to trying to build up all kinds of things for themselves, because there is no gain. Rather, we receive life as a good gift from God. We do our daily work for his glory, always seeking to abound in the work of the Lord. We seek first his kingdom, recognizing that anything we do for him is not in vain. And friends, all of these good gifts of God, they all point to something beyond themselves. For Jesus took bread and he said, I am the bread of life. Jesus said, he is the living water, the thing that truly satisfies which you are looking for. And Jesus says, there is a day coming when all of his people, all who believe in him, will sit down at the greatest wedding feast you have ever imagined. And he invites us to us, saying, anyone who thirsts, come and drink from the water of life. Do you want true and lasting joy? Then bow the knee to your Creator. Say, Jesus, forgive my sins. I want to live for you. I want to seek first your kingdom. And then get up, enjoy your lunch, go to work and use what God has given you, no matter how small, for his glory. For Jesus has risen from the dead, and anything done in his name is not in vain. Let's pray together. Father, we thank you for your word. The way that your Spirit-inspired word confronts us, the way that it encourages us, the way it makes us wise. Help us all to live wisely before you. As a church, we want to seek first your kingdom. As a church, we want to, first of all, focus on showing who you are, Jesus, for you are worthy of all praise, all glory. As a people, right now, we bow before you and say, you are our Creator. We bow before you and we ask your forgiveness for any sins we have committed against you, for any ways we have abused your good gifts. Help us to live wisely in your world. Help us to use our gifts and talents for your glory. For Jesus, we long for the day when we will all stand before you and cry out, worthy is the Lamb who was slain. You are worthy of all praise and of all worship, and it's in your name that we pray. Amen.